What got you interested in covering terrorism?
You know, my brother almost, my brother Brendan almost died in the 9/11 attacks. I was working for the Wall Street Journal in Brussels, and he was working for the Journal in New York, and disappeared for the first 9 hours. I knew he would take the 8:30 train from Brooklyn, the subway into Manhattan, and get off at number 5 World Trade and walk up the steps and across the bridge to the Journal building. And so he would have been getting off the train as the first plane hit at 8:48. And disappeared. We were unable to find him for about nine and a half hours. And what had happened is, fortunately, he had cut himself shaving. He was standing on the platform in Brooklyn waiting for the 8:30 train, noticed blood on his shirt, went home to change his shirt, ended up taking the last train into Manhattan, which didn't go all the way to the World Trade Center. It stopped at Christopher Street, saved his life. But then in the crowd and the dust and the long walk across the Brooklyn Bridge and through the shock streets of Brooklyn, you know, he was unable to get a phone call out to let us know he was alive. But it made me think, you know, what did we know about bin Laden before these attacks? And why did they want to kill us? And I realized I developed a lot of sources over the years covering Third World Wars and revolutions. I had a lot of intelligence and military sources in North Africa and in the Middle East and in Southeast Asia where Al-Qaeda was active that would be useful in offering a unique reporting perspective. And so there's an old saying in investigative journalism, if you don't go, you don't know. I started traveling and reporting both for the Wall Street Journal and then later for the Sunday Times of London and then for my own books. Talking to a lot of these people face-to-face, I spent hours with one of bin Laden's roommates in Khartoum, for example. Most, you know, as you meet the different people connected to bin Laden, you really get a deeper sense of the guy. One person who really surprised me was bin Laden's gardener.
His gardener?
Yeah.
He had a gardener?
Yeah, in Khartoum, he lived in behind this these 10-foot-high concrete walls that were topped with broken bottles. And as I got a tour of his house, this is after bin Laden left, obviously. I saw this willow tree growing. Now, willows use a tremendous amount of water. And here you are on the edge of the Sahara Desert in Khartoum, Sudan. And I said, you know, why did he plant this tree, this willow tree that's using so much water? And the Sudanese intelligence official who'd agreed to show me bin Laden's house said, oh, that's a good question. Well, here, we'll give you the name and number of the gardener. And I tracked him down in East Khartoum, and I talked to him. He spoke pretty good English. And he said that bin Laden asked him to plant the tree on purpose. He wanted it as a sign to his neighbors to show that he could afford the water bill.
Oh, jeez. Ego.
Yeah, it's these real-life details that bring these guys to life and really give you a different perspective on these people.
I had a relative by marriage who was on Flight 175.
Wow.
Leaving Boston, heading for L.A. that never made it. Doug Gowell, if anybody wants to Google search him, he was the brother of my mother's sister's husband.
Wow.
And he was going to L.A. He was working for Avid Technology. He was the new marketing director and never made it.
Yeah, one of the guys on the first plane was an ex-Israeli Special Forces guy, and he's believed to have fought it out with two of the hijackers. I mean, the stories of some of these people on the planes, not just the Pennsylvania flight, but all the planes, are fascinating.
What do you think happened on that plane, Richard?
Pennsylvania flight?
You know, on any of them, in terms of just what they did and how they took them over.
Well, this is where, you know, I think we really need to investigate more, because there's absolutely no evidence of box cutters. If you look at the flight recorders, you look at the transcripts of all the phone calls made by both passengers and crew on each of the hijacked planes, they mention a variety of weapons, knives. One mentions a gun. There's a mysterious sort of chemical device, which may just be a fake, you know, them trying to fake out the passengers and scare them. But nobody mentions box cutters. And box cutters were initially suggested in a press conference the first few hours after the 9/11 attacks, because it was the only knife that was really sanctioned by FAA rules.
Well, you know, I was going to say, how did we know if they had box cutters? How did we even know they did?
It was speculation, and it's one of these speculations that got hardened into fact without any evidence. But no passenger or crew member describes a box cutter. There's no box covers recovered from the wreckage, right? There's no record of anyone checking a box cutter, nor would there be, I suppose. But the box cutters are a very handy suggestion to say that the FAA was doing its job. And the fact is, we know it wasn't. We know that that Al-Qaeda chose the airports that it did, Logan and Boston, Dulles and Washington and so on, because they were ranked as the top five worst airports on the website of the Department of Transportation because they repeatedly failed security checks.
Weren't those cockpit doors always locked prior to that anyway? I can't remember anymore.
Oh, no, they were often open. And in fact...
So you could, like, look down the aisle and you could look right in, right?
You could look right in. And, you probably remember the days when small children would be invited into the cockpit.
Yeah, I remember that. That's
get true. A little toy metal plane or something from the crew. Also, on some flights, union rules allow the pilots, if the captain says so, to smoke. And so what would happen is the flight attendants would go into the cockpit to get a quick cigarette break. Not allowed for the passengers, obviously. And so those doors were open for a variety of reasons. And then, of course,
at what point do you think these hijackers were in control of the plane? Right after takeoff?
Fairly soon afterward, because the transponders go dark. They knew exactly what they were doing. That's another reason why, by the way, the jet fighters that were scrambled out of western Massachusetts were unable to find them. They were hiding in a very crowded commercial airspace, and their transponders were off. And so it was very hard to locate them. But the transponders go off within depending on the flights, 9 to 15 minutes in. I think the Dulles flight had the transponder on the longest, and that was 20 something minutes.
I think at this point, if I saw four or five guys get up and start rushing the cockpit, I think I just jump out in front of them as well as everybody else would.
You know? I think that would be the natural reaction.
Yeah. One, you think he's going to the bathroom. Four people, five people at one time like that? Nah, there's something wrong.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how quickly the passengers figured this out, right?
Yeah.
It didn't take a lot. We're not France. We don't require a government directive to figure things out. I don't think that form of attack would work again, but they're actively looking for other weak spots in our system. I mean, one of the reasons why Boston Logan had such a bad record is that the governor had appointed as the head of airport security his former chauffeur.
Oh, geez.
And so, you know, they study our websites. They study our newspapers and magazines and news broadcasts looking for weakness.